ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, I'm Sana Qadar, and I host All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. If you've ever wondered why people behave the way they do, or what it's like to live inside their heads, this is the show for you. We dive deep each week into a topic related to mental health or psychology, from the promise and perils of manifesting, to how to get better sleep, to what it's like to experience psychosis. Hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Today on Big Ideas, meet a force of nature and of song. So there's a medicine to this, a sort of social medicine in a way.
I suppose I shouldn't say it in such strong terms, but it does feel like, I am a healer. No, it's just more like I'm trying to listen and respond. What do I think people feel like? The moments that I think have sparked online, like the viral moments, are when I did get it just right. Like at the beginning of COVID, I picked the song Close to You by The Carpenters because it says, I wish I was close to you. And that had a great mouth feel for people when they sang along, and it just seemed to hit the spot. And I do think there are songs for every ailment and mood that we have, and it's about ferreting around and trying to decide overall what would feel good.
Now, you could call Astrid Jorgensen a choir conductor, but that doesn't really quite capture what she does and this global phenomenon that she's created on any one night, anywhere in the world. You might find Astrid on a stage in front of a few thousand people singing their hearts out. She is the founder, the composer, the host of Pub Choir, which has been described as the world's biggest one-night stand-in song. But there's much more to her story, which she shares in her new memoir called Average at Best. And Astrid joins me and you at Melbourne's beautiful Fitzroy Town Hall on Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung country for this event organised by Northern Books in Castlemaine. It's a perfect conversation for the festive season, I reckon. Astrid Jorgensen! Thank you. You describe this memoir as embracing the mediocrity of life. It's called Average at Best. You're going to have to do a lot of convincing to tell me that you're average or your life has been mediocre.
I think all of us are kind of average if you average it out. Like, I am okay to admit that I have become very good at something. In fact, I reckon I might be the best at pub choir because I'm the only one doing it. So it's an easy claim to, I guess you could say I'm also the worst, but I'm the only one doing it. So I have become really good at my job, but you can never begin at best. You have to wade through quite a lot of mediocrity to arrive anywhere that has a semblance of good. And in realizing that about myself, I kind of thought, everyone sees this one version of me on stage as this really confident person who is commanding a room of thousands, and doesn't she seem so in control? I am the curator of my own image, and we all are. Yeah. I think we have arrived at a place in our Western society where we deeply curate how we present ourselves to each other, even though we know it's a lie. Or not the whole truth, at least. And so I thought I'd go first. I really do think I am good at my job, but I have done so many things that were underwhelming to allow me to arrive there. And in this kind of nice way, as I wrote the book called Average at Best, I realized that all of those things mattered just as much as the sliver of best that I have found in my work. I was collecting ingredients for this recipe I didn't even know I was cooking. Yeah. You know, like, I have tried so many jobs. I'm sure many of us have, but, you know, I've been a funeral singer and a cleaner and a barista and a school teacher, and I was the literal worst bed sheet sales of a global bedding chain. They told me that I had the lowest average in the entire country.
Oh, that's encouraging.
They fired me. So they were like, this is why. You are truly bad at this. That was all part of the recipe for pub choir.
But I think also there's this idea that freeing yourself of perfection, and I think you probably are a bit of a perfectionist, and I hard relate to that, but it also allows you to really seize the day rather than feel encumbered by this sense that everything has to be right.
Yes, I mean, you can never be right all the time. I am for sure a perfectionist, but I'm trying to reframe it to myself. We might not be the best at anything ever, but we can try our best and we can feel better.
I'm just wondering whether some of that feeling about the striving comes from being the youngest child in a household of seven. You had four older brothers, so there were seven people in your house. What was that vibe like for little Astrid?
It's six people too many. My family, you know, all my brothers are so clever. My parents, my dad's the first in his family to go to university. Education and hobbies and activities was a big focus in our house, so it was noisy. Mm. And one of my brothers plays the bagpipes. You know, like, we were trying a lot of different things and all of them were so noisy. And I, of course, being the last one to come up through the ranks of the family, they were all, you know, getting A's at school and doing so well. And when you're the last one to arrive, it's not miraculous if you also get an A. In fact, it's like the bare minimum. You've fallen over the bar.
Was music part of your childhood?
Yeah. I mean, I had music lessons, violin and piano as a kid. And my family...
The violin teacher.
I mean, I'm from an Asian household. My mum's from Singapore. And piano and violin is very common... kind of the double prong crying on the weekends lessons. But I think my parents saw it as development, not necessarily as the creative destination. I think they saw music as a tool to develop your mind so that you can do other important things. But I got stuck on step one of just wanting to create stuff. But unfortunately, it was interwoven with a terrible teacher.
You got stuck with Ms. B.
Yeah.
Ms. B.
Little Ms. B.
The soul destroyer.
Yeah, it's sort of... As someone who
I hope she's not listening. I really actually hope she's
kind
not
of,
listening.
I think she might listen to your show.
But you'd end up at the end of every class on the floor almost sobbing.
Yeah. I mean, I have been...
It's a great educational model, isn't it?
Yeah. I have been a teacher of children and a musical teacher one-on-one with children. And it never crossed my mind to try and destroy them in order to get a better result. But as a child, you trust that the adults know more than you. So I just assumed that she had a reason for behaving like this week to week. There were private lessons one-on-one and she would, I mean, not to overstate it, trauma is not a competition. I know that there are worse things in this world. But she would just, to my face, just tell me I was stupid every week and that I'm the worst student she's ever had. I'm so annoying.
Punitive.
Yeah, just making me cry. I would just cry every single week. And I was left alone in there for 1 hour each week. It was a strange, you know, repetitive action to go through for 4 years as a child. And I really just believed her.
And your brothers loved her.
Well, I had one other brother also had lessons with her and he would go in before me and then he would come out and she would tell me how brilliant he is. And the weird thing is, no shade to my brother, but he would never do as well in his exams as I would. And so, like, external people would give me an A+ and give him like a B. And then she would say, but he's so brilliant. But I think, you know, I think I just pissed her off really because I was musically capable without her. And so she didn't know how to harness that. I have empathy for the idea that a precocious little child one-on-one can get under your skin, but it is the adult's job to figure out how to work with that child to find something better together.
The top 40 hits on radio, though, totally captured you. And, I mean, when I was a kid, I was obsessed with radio even as a child.
Well, look at your job now.
Yeah,
it's worked out.
Random. I went to a lot of schools, so radio was almost like the school of the airwaves for me and a kind of constant companion and friend. And so I joined, of course, the 3KZ Koala Club and got stickers and got your name called out on air every now and then. So that was a very sweet little... similar probably age, you were conducting a heist. You were swindling a local radio station presented by, and I might have to vomit in my mouth a bit,
Kyle Sanderlands and Jackie O.
Now that I, as an adult, understand what kind of people I think that they are.
They were your role models.
I am okay to have stolen from their from their radio show. But I did have a bit of a, like a, you know, a racket going on. It's funny that you say that you grew up loving the radio. I literally attended school of the radio in New Zealand. I grew up in rural New Zealand for a short time and went to school via the radio. So the radio is this, like,
my dream.
Yeah, it was so incredible. And it, like, I would receive parcels of homework in the mail, and then I would put my earphones on and just have like little child ear excitement with my teacher talking to me, just like with her sultry teacher voice over the airwaves. So I just had this incredibly positive association with the radio. And so when my family moved to Australia, I would listen to the radio every single night of the week for 4 hours. Because they would count down the top 40 Australian songs every single night. Because this is when we still had CDs. And so the charts would genuinely change every day. People would buy CDs. I would listen and I would write down the 40 songs in order, and I would chart their progress, and I would learn my favourites, and then I would get my cassette tape, because I didn't have any money to buy CDs. I would get my cassette tape and record my favourites. Oh, I knew they were coming up. And then one night I did call in. They asked for callers and I was listening all the time. I thought callers were kind of like celebrities on the show. They're just idiot children like me, but I thought that they were like famous people, and I called up and they put me through and I mumbled something terrible. I put it in the book, you know, it was just a word salad, but they sent me a free CD to say thank you for calling the show. And immediately I was like, I need to get more CDs. Like, there's free CDs, just it's so easy. And so I called again and again, and I probably had about, I don't know, 5 or 10 CDs when they started to learn that the lady on the phone running the switchboard learned my name, and she was like, you have to stop calling. This is greedy. And I was like, yeah, no worries. I'll stop calling. And then I kept calling, but I started to use different names every single night. And I would, and there were real names of my friends from school. And I would say, and I had all their, I was
it gets
like,
worse.
I was like Rain Man with these addresses. I had everyone's address memorized, and I would send them to their house and then ask them to bring them to me at school. And I had hundreds and hundreds of CDs. But then unfortunately, I said something funny as one of my fake friends. Kira was the name of my actual best friend at school, and I was Kira on the radio show, and they laughed at something that Kira said.
You were talent.
Yeah, I was talent spotted. And they asked for my number. Could they write it down? And could they call my house? Could they call Kira's house and get her if they needed anyone last minute? And of course I said yes, because I said, you know, we'll give you CDs if in return. And then they started to call my house so much, like multiple times a week, the phone would ring for Kira, who does not exist at my house. And I would have to parade past the phone, trying to intercept every single call.
Before mobile phones.
Yeah, keep the lines clear. I was lying. I was like a throne of lies. And to cut a very long story short, I got away with everything. And I know they're not listening to this, so.
And now you're having a national confessional about it.
They don't care.
At 16, you finish school and your friends are all off snogging at schoolies. What are you doing?
I did get on a flight by myself to Zambia in Africa to secretly go to a convent and become a Catholic nun. Which, like, I know it doesn't sound like a real story, but it is, actually, is that I thought that I was in love with Jesus. I must admit now I am at best agnostic, but certainly an atheist. But I grew up in a Catholic family, and I would go to church every week, and I loved church because it was this beautiful ritual where we would sit down and everyone, like, the top hits would come on. It was like Kyle and Jackie O, but suburban version, where it was like Catholic hymns, and some of them are real bops. I love the Galilee song. You know, if you know, you know. And you know, when a hit would come on at church, everyone sort of sat up in their seat, and we would sing. It was like this beautiful connective moment, and I thought that that was the feeling that I had, was loving God, but it took me a really long time, and via Zambia, I hopped on a plane. I told my parents I wanted to visit my auntie, who is a nun. So that's the connection. She lived in Zambia.
This is Aunt Jacinta.
My auntie Jacinta. She is still a Franciscan missionary of the Divine Motherhood. And she just lived this life of service in Zambia. And I said I wanted to just hang out with her and go on a safari. And my parents, who are insane, said, yeah, of course. So I was 16 and I went alone to Africa for 2 months.
They didn't know anything about this, no, idea, I did this not, desire to be a nun.
No, I didn't tell them. I just said I'd go on a safari and I'd hang out in Africa. And they were like, what could go wrong? Sure. And I went and I disclosed to my auntie that I was thinking about it. And she said, well, she ran the postulant, the intake nun service. And so she said, well, come and live with us. And so I would wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and we would go to mass and we would pray 5 times a day and we'd do the offices. And I loved it.
And your other role model was Whoopi Goldberg and Sister Act. Yeah,
yeah? I was living my Sister Act 2 back in the habit dream, where I was having like a montage moment where I was like going from this ragtag noisy life in Australia to like this prayerful, reflective, music-filled life. Because the one thing that you might not know if you've never been to Zambia in a church service is that the music is the most incredible thing I personally have ever heard. I could not even fathom the richness of the vocal harmonies, the complexity and ease with which every single person, hundreds and hundreds of people, this is not like a manky old suburban Australian church service where there's like 12 people. This was like pumping. Mm-hmm. People were alive. And
pulling tambourines out of their handbags.
Yeah, they were literally pulling tambourines out of their handbags. Yeah. And I had never felt so like engulfed with joy and communal optimism and like community and music. And so it further affirmed that I loved Jesus because I just felt so alive there. But it took me a while to extract out the idea that I'm in love with music. I love communal singing. And that was like the gold standard of it. And so I felt so connected to everyone and I wanted to immerse myself in that life. But I'm not even sure I believe in God. I really believe in music.
And in a sense, the divinity of music in some sense.
Yes, like you become the creator when you sing. You are transformed from like the receiver of art to the person who creates something with your own body. And we were given a voice, or we were created. We exist with a voice in our bodies. And it's like when you come to that realization and you sing, you are the artist and the art. Like this to me is spirituality, and I think it's incredible and it exists now on earth inside your body. Like this really is sort of my religion, is singing, and group singing together is so spiritual to me, but it is unattached to a divine being. I think it's us, really.
Astrid Jorgensen, founder of the collective singing event, which goes by the name of Pub Choir. It's gone global, it's gone viral, and it makes people feel damn good. And you are joining Astrid and me, Natasha Mitchell, at the Fitzroy Town Hall in Naarm, Melbourne today, here on ABC Radio National's live event show, Big Ideas.
It's so interesting, though, that religion is the crucible, but everything is the crucible for music and song and dance in African communities. And yet here, sometimes religion is sort of part of our repression around dance, expression, musicality. Yes, hymn is powerful, but there's also a sort of control of full expression.
I think this has become a side quest for me. I didn't know this when I started out, but it is important to me to put out into the world that nobody has a monopoly on happy clapping. We are allowed to be joyful and sway our hands to music, and it can be for us and for each other. Like, I deeply respect the church ritual and the idea that you are devoting yourself to something beyond yourself. I think that's a really beautiful thing to do and to believe. But the church, no denomination owns musical congregation experiences. People sometimes write emails to me saying, like, what church is Pub Choir attached to? Because they've seen the photos of people waving their
arms.
And I'm like, it's the church of people. Like, we're allowed. And I pay tax, so it's really different so to they church. You know, it's like a whole other thing.
So they think you're sort of running sort of these evangelical,
well, the
you know, sheds out in the outer suburbs of most of the cities.
Maybe that's the only time people have seen this huge communal music joy experience, but Music does not belong to any church. I'm glad that it's there, but music outside of the church belongs to everyone whenever we want. I mean, it would be annoying to sing all the time, but like we're allowed to sing and feel joyful and to clap our hands in a happy way and to feel connected just because we exist. That's allowed for all of us.
Now, Auntie Jacinta put you to work. She really did test your mettle and test your faith and test your ambitions to become a nun. What did she get you to do over there?
Well, I did. I mean, so she is also a trained nurse, and so she would go into home care for HIV and AIDS sufferers in Zambia. I, at 16, as an idiot, was not the right person to maybe go into those situations, but I went in with humility and she just said, clean this, do that, dress this wound, and there's no one else there doing this work, so roll up your sleeves and help, find a way to help. It was so overwhelming for me, and I realised like maybe nunhood is like quite an intense thing to do in that way. She let me follow her into schools where they were teaching it like hubs of education for kids with no shoes, turning up and learning the alphabet together. Like it was fully boots on the ground stuff that she was doing. And I thought it was so important and so impressive and admirable, and I wanted to be like her, but it was the church music that was my number one reason for becoming a nun. And how quiet it was at the convent. And I realised later that becoming a nun for the lifestyle benefits of like great music gigs and quiet, a bit of shush at night is not a good reason to become a nun. You should really love God first of all.
That's right. I mean, you then made contact with an order of nuns back in Australia, but they said, just go away and experience a bit of life first.
Yes.
And there was some wisdom in that recommendation.
Absolutely. Thank goodness. Thank God for that nun in Australia. There are the Franciscan Missionaries of the Divine Motherhood. They have a chapter in Australia in Bendigo. And I wrote to them when I got back and I said, look, just on the down low, haven't told my parents, which is a red flag. She's like, you are a small child. But I was like, I haven't told my parents, but I would like to become a nun. I've spent 2 months doing it. I'm cut out for this. And can I come and live in Bendigo at the convent? And she was like, absolutely not. You are 16 years old. It's not old enough. You should go and experience something in life. Go to university, go get a job, come back to me. We're always here. It's so lovely that you have this passion for what we do and for this life and for God. But she didn't know that I was I was sly. But I did go to university and I fell in love with a human boy. And yet,
in first year university, who you are still in love with.
It's been 18 years. We could have had a whole adult child.
Hear
by
the
now.
Audience.
But I met him and I fell in love with him. And yet, my love and fiery passion for music was unchanged. And that's when I started to extract these ingredients, being like, I am in love with music. And that has sort of nothing to do with Jesus, which I thought I was going to marry Jesus.
Or Mrs. B.
Or Mrs. B. Yeah, no.
You had liberated yourself from her.
I had. Yeah, finally, when I got to university and I learned about music and I sung in choirs with people who also loved music, I felt that same joy and connection that I had felt in these other places. And it was unreligious. And I realised that, yeah, I just love singing.
You didn't feel joy being a school teacher of music, though.
Have you met children?
Are there any school teachers here? High school teachers? Oh, wow.
They get
a whole cohort of the audience are high school teachers. You have my respect.
And are you tired?
Deep respect.
Yes, they're so tired.
You're always tired. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? School, like Ms. B, can extract the love out of many things. Sorry, no offence. What you do, I think you should be paid more than the Prime Minister.
Absolutely.
It's the most important job in the world, I think. But it did not resonate with you.
I just, for so many reasons, but I think I was too performative. I thought it was like a gig. I had to entertain them. They're not there for a comedy show. They just want someone to listen to them and to see them and to give them the information for the test. But I felt myself going a bit mad, trying to get a reaction out of adolescents in the classroom. And the one thing that is a teenager's right is to never show you with their face what they're feeling. And that is correct. That's what all teenagers must do to get to adulthood. You must never tell anyone with your face and your expressions what you're thinking.
It's in their job description.
Neutral or less at all times.
They signed the contract.
Yes. And so I would be like, I have a very specific memory of me in a class jumping on a table and high kicking, trying to explaining something, some song, you know, like just so too much. Just trying to get the audience, which is what I was thinking of the students, get the audience to clap or something. But they're just at school tired, you know, they just want some information. So I think I was taking it too far. But it's because I guess another layer below that is that I don't personally find much joy in the comparative nature of creativity. So, you know, kids would come along and they've been practicing for a whole term this one song, and then they sing it and their voice is shaking and they've put everything into it, and then you're like, it's a C. I didn't love it. And you've got to write these report comments and destroy a child's love of music because of what? Some metric. I think there is certainly a place for comparative learning. You know, I think it's good so that we know what each other is doing and we can keep up, you know, but I just didn't feel right. I felt terrible looking a kid in the eye and just being like, you didn't sing it according to this metric and so you failed this class. So
it's a tough gig.
It's a tough gig. I think teachers are so tough. I just wasn't tough enough. And so I was looking always for ways to make music for the experiential nature of
it. You were tough enough, though, to take up the invitation of not just conducting a small class choir, but an entire multi-generational, multi-class school choir that was the entire school, a school in Townsville.
Yes.
That changed everything.
I considered very seriously quitting music altogether.
And becoming an air traffic controller. That would be your natural inclination, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, I went through the process of recruitment. I took the test and for months and months I studied to be an air traffic controller and I passed all
why?
These different...
Just
I don't know, why?
Why
not? I put it in the book. I had reasons. And it was I just didn't feel like music was working out for me. I didn't feel welcome as a music maker. I don't know, it didn't feel right. And I was invited to take the final face-to-face interview to become an air traffic controller. And the same week, I received an email from a school in Townsville asking me that they've been looking for someone to take up compulsory whole school high school choir, 500 kids. Compulsory, no one's allowed to opt out of choir. And they said, someone said you would be perfect. And I, like, validation is my drug. And I was like, I'll do it. Someone wants me. So I turned up and I had been teaching, but I had been ready to let it go. I did write out a lesson plan. You know, I mean, I was a loose teacher, but I was still doing my job. I wrote out the things I thought should happen in this hour of compulsory choir. And I marched onto this outdoor stage, just dripping in sweat because Townsville is very hot. And I didn't look at my lesson plan once. And in this moment, I had never felt it before, I realized that I knew what to do. I knew what to say next without even thinking about it. I was like almost like I saw my arms moving, my mouth was saying stuff, I was singing things. I didn't look at my lesson plan. I just looked at the audience and listened to what they did and I just understood how to make 500 people sing.
Well, it wasn't just I love the way you describe it, 500 people with their old eyes rolling back in their head.
Not one eye was in the forward position, but by the end...
Because this was so not cool.
Yeah, but by the end they were singing. Like, in fact, within the first 30 seconds, I just feel like I said the right thing or something and everyone was like, oh, all right, well, here's this lady, let's try it. And by the end of that, the entire school had become a choir. And then I went back week after week and everyone was singing and looking forward to it. And then a non-compulsory choir started. People were like, can I have some more, please? And then they asked for singing lessons. And I built this like little community so quickly. And it made me realize that every single thing that I had been doing had led me to this moment of just on that sliver of best on stage for 1 hour in front of these children, I knew what to do.
And so this is the genesis of Pub Choir.
There it is.
which began in 2017.
The next year, yeah.
In a pub in Brisbane. And what, you post something on Facebook, come along, you know, yeah. Have a sing in a pub. And who turns up?
Well, 30 people RSVP'd to the online event and I was like, this is going to be incredible. 30 people is a huge choir. Like, I was like, that's a classroom, but of adults. Like, it's a huge number. And then 70 people came. And again, I seemed to know what to do.
And it was a one-night stand. There was no obligation that they would come back. They were there to sing one night, no practice, out they go afterwards.
Yes, I had no plan to do this again and again, but I did feel something shift when I did that first show. And in the book, it's so earnest. I'm embarrassed, but I'm not. I keep a diary. I kept dear diary. Like I'm still stuck in my teenage 12-year-old calling Kyle Sanderlands, but I do keep a journal pretty faithfully. And I put my journal entry from that night. And it's so earnest, but I say, I think I've just discovered what I'm supposed to be doing with my life. Like, I even understood then. I didn't plan anything. I don't know what's happening tomorrow even, but I, in that moment, understood that I had arrived at something that only I can do and that it felt right. I finally found the thing I was cooking. I was collecting all these ingredients for this soup, mm-hmm. And here it was.
The messy, marvellous soup of a life full of flavour. Hey, Astrid Jorgensen, the founder of Pub Choir, described as the world's biggest one-night stand in song, is my guest on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas today. Hello, Natasha Mitchell with you. Astrid creatively arranges popular songs for thousands to sing together. Crowds turn up, they learn, they laugh. Most of all, they connect deeply, lovingly, joyously through song. But it all started with that first night in a Brisbane pub. What was the feeling in that room? Which it now is a feeling with the world's biggest choir.
Yeah.
That you have night after night at venue after venue all over the world.
It really has snowballed a little bit out of control.
just a little bit.
But I mean, I say this with full honesty from my heart. It's the same feeling now. It's surprise. But not from me. I always believe in the destination because I've planned the song and I have started to really believe that I can get us there. But it's every single night, I delay the gratification for the audience the entire time. We are, edging towards this performance. And I never let the audience sing what they've learned all in one go until the very end of the show. I say, we'll chip away at it. Here's the next line, one more line. Here we go. But then only at the end of this sometimes two-hour show.
With 2,000 people.
With 2,000 people. I'll say, not yet. And then just in the last 3 minutes, we'll sing the song. And in that moment, people truly are shocked with themselves. They are so overcome that they were a part of the music making and the art. And it happens without fail. Even to people who have come to the show a lot, it's always a different arrangement. I write a bespoke arrangement to teach every audience. And even if I'm teaching the same arrangement, the people are always different. You don't know how it's going to come together. It can feel so different, even the same venue two nights in a row, because the people feel different. And so in that moment where we sing that final 3-minute version of the song, it has never existed like that before and it will never be like that again. And people are overcome, overawed, surprised, and I'm just so chuffed I get to be their audience.
What do you see when you look out at a crowd of people?
Do you know what's crazy? I shouldn't admit this. Lucky no one's listening. No, we're on a national radio show. I never look at really at anyone because I can't get too caught up in each individual face. I'm too busy listening. And even just a few nights ago, I was on tour and my videographer said, I don't know how you ignored that woman bawling her eyes out in the front row. And I was like, what do you mean? And everyone in my crew were like, you're a monster. How did you not notice? There was a woman in the front of the very front
weeping.
Row and she was weeping the entire show. And I was like, was she okay? And they're like, she was happy. And I'm like, oh, I've missed the whole bloody thing. But it's like, I think if I looked into the faces of everybody and tried to understand what's going on, I could never finish the show. I'm at work. I'm listening and I'm trying.
You're throwing your body around.
Yeah.
It's a really acrobatic show.
I'm thinking as fast and as hard as I can, just trying to think of the next thing that we need to do to get us to the end of this song. And afterwards, I close my hotel door or whatever and I lie in my bed and I think, holy shit, I can't believe what just happened. It hits me later. I reflect later, but I sort of leave the audience to their own feelings.
It's not just any song though. I mean, we're having a chat before and apparently people get quite pissed off about certain songs. You know, people have very, very specific needs and it... It is the 80s, it seems. Universally, it is the 80s across all generations somehow. But those songs that you're performing or getting an audience to perform are often the songs that have defined key points in people's lives. Like it's entwined with their sense of self. Huge nostalgia, huge feeling.
I suppose I do understand why that period of music is the one that everyone wants, because that, I think, was when we last listened to the same stuff together. Like now, you can listen to anything you want at any time. It is infinite how much you could shape your own personal taste. So we're not listening to the same stuff really anymore. And so I feel like the 80s, the 90s, just at the beginning of the noughties, is when we still listened to the same songs. Even if you didn't like them, we all knew the same songs. And so sometimes a song can be too well known and it's hard to undo. I can't stop people from just singing the melody the whole time, and that's not the point of my show. You can sing along with any song anytime you want for free. Why would you pay to come to my show? You've wasted your money. I'm trying to make a different version of the songs, and it almost helps not to be too invested in the song. It's just the vehicle for making something together, but I fully appreciate that the song is like the number one concern for my audience and for people
coming
to
the show.
They write to you. Oh, constantly I'm getting complaints.
After the show.
People are disappointed personally that I didn't pick this song and, oh, it's not as good as this song. And someone wrote to me asking for a refund because this song reminded them of their ex-boyfriend, and I was like, I just can't know that. I think it's probably a good litmus test. If you are going to be pissed off at the show because it's not your personal favourite song, it wasn't the show for you anyway, because I was going to ruin it. I was going to ruin your favourite song anyway, because I was going to do a whole bunch of stuff that wasn't there to begin with.
I'm interested in that point that you made, though, about communal listening. And, you know, when an album came out, it was a massive moment. And it was, I don't know about you, but I'd go back and put the record player or the CD cue back on track 7, listen to it a million times. But you'd listen all the way through. There was a sort of curated narrative arc that someone was handing you, this beautiful thing in a CD case or an album cover. It was just a beautiful object, and there was a real sense of
ritual, ceremony
and cultural ritual. And I mean, we could say we've lost stuff.
Yeah.
Perhaps we've gained other things, but certainly what you're doing is creating the space for communal performance, something very powerful, and particularly post-COVID. And I don't know whether any of you saw the incredible COVID video. Who participated in that
couch
Astra
choir.
Did? Yeah, couch choir instead of pub choir.
It's okay, I won't judge you.
Couch choir was
just for the listeners
phenomenal
at home,
thing where
no
well, you describe couch choir, but that was a reminder that you were giving us something that we had lost. This singing together alone in lockdown was profound.
Oh, thank you. I mean, that was really special for me too, because singing was together was illegal. Like my job, my singing together business, it was having a rough time during COVID, as we all were. But
No. Melbourne had the worst time.
Yes. I would never.
We had the world's longest lockdown.
I would never compete.
We like to remind people of that.
I will never.
I know
forget.
We've had to stop, but now is our moment to say it.
I'll never forget Melbourne. Thank you. It was strange for me because my life's work had disappeared and I had no other skills, and I was not going to go back in the classroom. So I thought, underneath it all, I got really wrapped up in my live show, but underneath all of that is just the premise that your voice is unique to you and it's better if you share it with other people. Like we will help each other cover and make a richer thing than you could ever make alone. And so singing still existed even though we couldn't do it in the same room. So that was a really nice reminder to me as well. I think I might have been too wrapped up in my own bullshit for a little bit there. On my way to America and going to South by Southwest Festival, like, isn't this a cool, special thing? But actually the
you
audience...
You were becoming hot stuff.
Yeah. The audience is the main character of all art. And if it is not... Because I said that to somebody and they're like, no, you can make art just for art's sake. And I'm like, well, then just go sing in the mirror. I think if you are creating something, it's for people. It's for each other. And it's okay to sing in the mirror, by the way. You could have a lovely time. But I think when we make something, it's to connect with someone else. And I think I might have got lost a little bit there, but it is really, it's never too much to be reminded that when you offer art to the world, it's for the audience and they are the main character. So at my show, it makes me feel less nervous all the time when I approach it. I am the facilitator of the information. It's not about how beautiful I sing. I hope no one thinks my voice is disgusting, but you know, I'm just giving information. Here is your note, here is your note, here is your note. And I give it to the audience and then they are the main characters. And I think that's, it's important for me to remember that all the time too.
Yeah, that COVID video where you got lots of people in lockdowns around the world to contribute a song and then you somehow brought it all together. That was a technological challenge into one screen. I'm sure there's probably apps to do that now. And put it out there. It just went gangbusters, a seriously viral video and just the most divine moment sitting on my couch in Melbourne lockdown. You know, that really launched things, didn't it?
Well, in a strange way, it just kept my live music business alive,
yeah.
Which in a time when it was illegal is incredible. I know it's not the common musician story during COVID, but for my one show called Pub Choir, we grew.
Yeah.
We grew an audience.
Okay, so there's a plot twist. You make noise, you create sound, you hate noise. This is actually, you have a visceral, probably diagnosable reaction, emotional and physical reaction to sound.
People have been so nice to me about this since I put the book out and since it's sort of gone out there. I would say I'm high functioning, okay, you guys?
Yeah.
Like, some people are like patting me being like, I'm so sorry for existing. I'm like, it is okay. But yes, I would say that undoubtedly sound is my most dominant sense. So I don't have audible thoughts. I think I learned that a lot of people have this sort of internal monologue. You can almost narrate what you're thinking as yourself by speaking in your head. I can't do that. I can't even see images. As soon as I close my eyes, I can just see my eyelids from the inside. I can't see things in my brain. And so when noise happens, it defeats any thought that I have because my thoughts are soundless, really. And so it's fine, right?
There's a word for that.
Misophonia is but I think sometimes we make things a bit too clinical. I'm fine. I don't think it's a medication I can take for it. But
we pathologize everything, don't
yes,
we? It's a possibly one of your unique traits and it possibly enables you to do what you do.
Well, I think
to have this heightened sensitivity.
Yes, I think I've tried to use it for good and not for evil. Because I'm really attentive to sounds. It's like I can't block them out. If I'm watching a movie and someone is chewing popcorn behind me, I can't really understand the plot. And so it's like the sound, I can't block it out. I'm just hearing a lot of stuff all of the time.
Heightened sensitivity to, I don't know, you know, when someone's got a nose they need to blow and it whistles.
Yes,
with every breath.
Oh,
or,
my God, straight to jail.
Or chewing. Yeah. Or chewing or just breathing, actually.
Yeah, I do.
I wonder how this goes down with Evan, your partner.
Oh, poor Evan. I put a list in the book called 13 Noises That Just Make Me So Furious, and there is really just a personal attack to Evan. And I say sorry at the end, sorry to Evan. But, you know, I understand that people are noisy. The world is noisy. I totally appreciate that. I wish you would stop. But I think it's more upon me to find ways to use it, as I say, for good and not for evil. So I found a way to do that at the show. Everyone make as much noise as you can, but I must admit, I then require like a silence chamber after the show, almost just to get my brain back into equilibrium.
Everywhere.
Yeah, I don't have any pockets on this dress, but please be assured in my jacket over there, I've got earphones everywhere. I think it's upon me to adjust for the noisy world, but it's nice to have an outlet to invite the noise in at the show. And just, it's almost like ODing on noise and seeing how much I can do with it.
It's a wild life that you're living, and I can imagine this incredible love that you found when you were 18 with Evan must be one of your grounding anchors. You were on America's Got Talent and you were very subversive because what did you do?
Well, yeah, they wrote saying, we've seen your clips online, would you like to audition? And I thought, absolutely not. Music is not competitive. That's crazy. Have you even seen my show? But then I thought about it. And I realised it's almost like saying the title of the show in reverse or with a different emphasis, America's Got Talent. And, it could be anywhere and say that message. I thought, wouldn't it be cool to just kind of you know, instead of worshipping at the stage, kind of flipping that around and being like, look, people are good enough. I'm not saying they're brilliant. No one gets better at singing at my show, but it's like we help each other make stuff, and it's always unique and more than we... You can never be in a choir alone. It requires other people. So I thought that would be a fun opportunity to do that. And lucky me, it was received that way as well. Yeah. Like I was really...
Oh, they two people voted for you, two people didn't
oh,
they?
Oh, yeah. Scary Spice can suck it. But yeah. it's fine.
Well, you're meant to be the talent and you're turning it on the audience?
Yeah. And it was crazy because like the Spice Girls are my childhood heroes. So I'm like standing in front of my hero and she's like, I don't like you. I'm like, oh, okay, no worries. But she's allowed to not like it. It's fine. I don't need her to like it, but I liked the idea of just, again, the audience is the main character even of this show. They're the ones who tune in. They're the ones who buy tickets. They watch the broadcast. Like, you are nothing without the audience. And here they are. And they have capabilities too. And I had to wait for like 4 months for it to come to air and to see how it
would
be
received.
While you
were touring in America.
Yeah, I went on tour in America and I couldn't find a TV and I sat in a laundromat in a hotel room and there was like this family doing their drying and it was like everything was clanking. I was in noise hell and I was trying to listen to the TV and my crew all sat there and watched this tiny monitor together with this family putting in quarters in this machine and then drying rocks in the dryer. And I watched it unfold and then I think I realised when I saw it, oh, I think it's going to be okay. And
now, how many people have seen it?
I think over 100 million. I know, it's so many.
Nuts. It's had implications. Because now celebrities want a bit of you and that must be just weird. So you're doing things like, you know, going and doing a pub choir with event with Richard Branson. What a surreal situation.
It is surreal and I like...
Do any of the artists, do you have famous artists come on stage with you and do a pub choir with their songs?
I used to try and recruit them a little bit more to make people interested. But I think I'm starting to realise that it is more impressive when the audience is the star. I wouldn't rule anything out. Like, you know, Missy Higgins, if you're listening, give me a call. But, like, that is special. But I think it is more impressive when the regular people, when we make stuff. And sometimes I'll send it to the management of the songwriter or the artist. You know, I did that with Kate Bush and it changed my life. Just her just speaking to me. She wrote an email and she said, I loved it. And it changed my life.
What was the song?
Running Up That Hill.
Oh my God.
I put, yeah, I mean, it's just everything. She is everything. I put it in the book. That one email changed my life, like in a tangible way. And so I put it in the book as well. But I, you know, that's really special for the artist to recognize that regular people have done something incredible together. They have made something, they have value added to the existing version of the art. I almost find that the more miraculous outcome. But yeah, not ruling out anyone. If you, yeah, just Google pub choir and send me an email.
I think you've actually sort of, you've reached Mecca with Kate Bush.
Oh yeah, that's a peak.
Nothing can compare really, can it?
I agree.
No. I don't want to give everything away in the book, but there is a little, and you don't dwell on this in the book, but it is a powerful section where behind all this joy, this spreading of joy and creativity and love and delight, and you're also wrestling with stuff about body.
Yeah.
And yet you're there on stage performing with, well, usually just your guitarist colleague. So it's a very, very exposing situation. You're up there in your skin. What were the struggles that you were wrestling with that ultimately Evan was an incredible support for you?
Yes, may the love of an Evan find everyone in this life. Yeah. It was such a delight to me to be able to tell the world how I see this person who I think is the one who fully sees me. So that was so nice because he's so quiet. And I think people, you know, like he's sort of like haunting the back of photos or something, but he's so active in the successes of my life. You know, he is the rock.
Met both doing an arts degree. He went on to do medicine. You went on to run pub choir.
Yeah, I wanted to be a doctor when I first started uni and he wanted to be a writer. And we have both achieved these goals as a couple. So I think that's nice that we both claim both things now. Yeah, look, I have struggled and I think many people do with the idea that the way that I look affects the way that people respect and believe me and how I can pass through this world. And unfortunately, I had some very reinforcing experiences as a younger person.
As many girls do.
Yeah, yeah. And it's
this rewarding of skinniness.
Yes.
As if somehow it's a sort of moral act to be skinny.
I have very genuinely one-to-one experienced the difference that the way that people will treat you and interact with you depending on what shape you're in, which is outrageous, but it's true and it's a real thing that happened to me. And it has been very hard for me to extract out the idea that there is a value to me that exists beyond the visual. And I think that my show has been so important to reinforce this to me all the time, but it was with the love of Evan and then eventually, you know, the right medical help that I was able to kind of bring myself out of that really horrible hole.
Pulling yourself out of an eating disorder.
Yeah, a really very affecting eating disorder that kind of controlled my life. One thing I will say is that I didn't realize until I wrote the book that when I could say, maybe you might call it recovery, like I stopped doing the action of a disordered relationship with eating, even though I think about it a lot. And I do detail that a little bit in the book. It's almost like an addiction. It's there, but I don't act on it, which I think that's a huge progress to make. But I, oh, thank you. But I realized when I wrote the book that when I finally came back into my body, like that's the way out. Through a disordered relationship with eating, you come to listen and trust your body, which is an evolutionary machine that knows how to keep you alive and gives you the cues that you need, that it knows even without you having to think about it. The moment that I was able to start listening and trusting my own body again was when Pub Choir started. It's like becoming, existing fully in the body that I have and listening to myself freed me to do the best thing that maybe I'll ever do. You know, like I had big ideas. We're on a show called Big Ideas. I feel like trusting myself was that the one step, the last piece in the puzzle that I needed to do this thing that I think I might have been born to do. And so I think that's a really powerful reminder for me, that realization that that's the timeline. If you step through there, there is so much richness of life on the other side.
And that process of also just releasing the shame and telling those closest to you of what's been going on that you haven't been able to reveal.
I only read about it in the book, actually, which was one hell of a family dinner, I must admit. But I, sorry. But now they know.
But even telling Evan, you know, that process of him going, well, I'm going to, no matter where you are, we're going to eat together.
Yeah, yeah.
Even if it's on the phone.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I put the thing that helped me through it, but of course it would be different for everybody. But having the right person to tell would be huge. There are foundations. If you don't have the right person in your life, there are people you can reach out to. But for me, how lucky that it was the person that I love that was able to not make me feel more ashamed, maybe feel less ashamed. And then, I just feel like after that, Evan has been the one person I will go to check in with about the reality of who I am. I think that's so important to keep
to keep you
on this track of, I think so many people struggle with a disordered relationship to eating. And the problem is you have to eat to stay alive. Unlike other addictions, you can't just avoid heroin, you know, like you do need to eat to live. And so I still every day check in with Evan and use this as sort of a way to keep in touch with my hunger and the reality, the shared reality of my existence. But I hope if you have a disordered relationship with your eating that you tell the right person you deserve that. You deserve someone to hold your hand through that and you didn't do anything wrong and there is such a way to feel better.
And that powerful process of coming back into your body and coming back through song as well, what a great lesson. What have you learnt from this whole experience of, you know, creating these events for people to sing their hearts out? What have you learnt about adults and their capacity to learn? That our capacity to kind of let that little bloom flower in us that is sometimes squashed through the pain of comparison or formal education settings or the workplace or all of those things?
I mean, I don't see myself as like being able to like have sage information that I've learned, but I love to observe that we can feel better. Like it's not about, it's, I'm talking like a 5% mood improvement for a little bit after the show, but it's just this idea that if you're not incredible, you don't deserve to engage at all. People come to the show and they put up their hands when I ask who's the worst singer in Melbourne, who's the worst singer in Ballarat, and like 800 people put up their hand and I'm like, well, it can't be all of you. Oh, it's just one of you. No. But it's like just the idea that everyone's walking around with this horrible shame. What a burden to have in your heart that you think you're literally the worst. You wish your voice was that powerful. It's like, I think it's okay to enjoy something and that to be the reason that you do it. I wouldn't say I've learned this huge lesson. It's more just I love to continually have it reinforced to me, and I hope for the audience that we can try our best, not to be the best, but just to feel better, and that it is so much easier with other people. It's so much easier to help each other feel better, to try our best. And no one gets better at singing at my show, but I really hope they feel better, and I see it happen and I choose to believe it.
And that the pulse of music is innate in all of us.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have a heartbeat.
If I'm on my soapbox, I could talk about this until every single person withers and leaves, but I really cannot impress enough the idea that you have a voice that will never exist outside of you. It has never existed before. No one will ever have the same one again. Your voice is entirely unique to you. You got it for free. Every single time you use it, the world is different. If you sing in a choir, it is necessarily different because you were there using your voice. It can only be you. And who cares if it's out of tune? It's not a crime. I think just the fact that you have this unique tool that will never be heard again, what more reason do you need to use it? Everything is different when you sing. Don't do it all the time. That's probably annoying. In the right circumstance, you literally change the world just in such a small, underwhelming way every time you sing, and it would be a shame not to explore that for yourself. I wish that for everyone.
Beautiful. Shall we have some questions?
Yeah. I cannot.
There's a roving mic.
I can't stop myself from answering a question. So if you really want to know something.
Hi, Astrid.
Hi.
I'm curious about the song selection. I've been to two of your pop choirs. So whilst you've just mentioned that not being too popular and too attached in terms of public, what components do you look for when you are choosing, or what would be a deal breaker that you're like, nope? You know, like in terms of ballad or pop or whatnot, are you looking for a big bridge or a big breakout? Like, what is thinking? Like, that's...
Yes.
See, I want you to do some punk stuff, but you won't.
Well, I never say never. I think, yeah, besides like enough knowability, because I don't want people to feel like they're failing. If every single person in the room feels like they don't know the song, it's not a good start to the show. But beyond that, honestly, I'm looking for repetition. Before pub choir, I would be like very into like, oh, look at this jazzy thing, and oh, it's like unknowable, this music. But now I'm like, oh my God, if verse one is the same as verse two, happy days. It's like such a lovely moment at the show if I slog my way through my ideas for verse one and everyone's like, oh, we can't learn anymore. And then I say, well, good news, verse two is the same. You've already done it. You've done the work, and people rejoice in themselves at that moment. So I love a repetition. Stop changing stuff in your songs. Honestly, the third ingredient, really, this is a little bit woo-woo, but I don't think that songs are right all the time for every situation. So for me, songs are more like they address the ailment. What song do you need for this moment? And so it's a strange position to be in to decide what to give. But it's almost like I put it in the book. It's like I go into a pharmacy of songs and I select the one for the group ailment, which I decide. So obviously I can get it wrong. But I sort of look at how things are going and I try and decide, well, what would feel right for this moment? Sometimes it is a punky, up song. Sometimes we need to mellow out and really feel our feels. I've just finished my biggest tour ever. I had 36,000 people come and learn one song from me across Australia and New Zealand. And I thought, what will I dispense in this moment? And I thought, the song that I picked, I decided I needed to put words inside mouths that would be good on this scale. Like, what would I want 36,000 people to say to each other? So I picked this 90s one-hit wonder song called You Get What You Give. Don't give up. You have a reason to live. The music's in you. I'm like, that song is not right for a small show, in my opinion. That was like, I needed that to be a big thing, and it felt right. Sure, people still complain about the song choice.
Oh, no.
I cannot pick everyone's favourite song.
So there's a medicine to this, a sort of social medicine in a way.
I suppose I shouldn't say it in such strong terms, but it does I am a healer. No, it's just more like, I'm trying to listen and respond. What do I think people feel like? You know, sometimes I get it.
I mean, there's a lot going on.
There's a lot going on, and we all feel differently. I'm the one who decides, so of course I get it wrong for some people. Sometimes I do get it just right, though. Like, say, the moments that I think have sparked online, like the viral moments, are when I did get it just right. Like at the beginning of COVID, I picked the song Close to You by The Carpenters because it says, I wish I was close to you. And that had a great mouth feel for people when they sang along, and it just seemed to hit the spot. And I do think there are songs for every ailment and mood that we have, and it's about ferreting around and trying to decide overall what would feel good.
Beautiful question. Thank you. Beautiful answer. Thank you. And we'll take two more questions. Thanks.
Thanks. I've been to a lot of pub choirs.
Thank you.
Bohemian Rhapsody. Firstly, congratulations on getting to the end. How did you feel about it once you'd been doing that for so long? Like, did you...
Relieved.
Yeah.
I mean, for those who don't know, I spent 2 years putting together one song because everybody always requests Bohemian Rhapsody. And for me, I'm like, I understand why you want that song. It's a great song. It is so musically hard. I would never teach that at a show. You would never come back. Everyone would complain. It would be so unsatisfying, so destroying. I've never heard in my life a single performance of that live that I thought was satisfying.
This is a tough ask, isn't it? Because you're
it's
taking
huge.
Classics, you've got, and you're rearranging them for voice.
And my point is that we are good. We can do good things. So
yeah.
I don't want to ruin that idea of like putting this impossible song and then it's terrible and everyone's like, so we can't do everything. No, you can't do everything. So I was like, how can I passively, aggressively address this situation? And so I decided the only way to do it faithfully, because I want the music to be good, I think it's possible within us, but I don't have enough time at the show. So I thought the only way to get a good, faithful version of that song with all of its complexity was to break it apart across different shows. And then I dug deeper and deeper and I'm like, oh my God, there's so many notes. I realized I would have to just do one phrase at every show. And sometimes there would be like 8 notes happening in this one word. It's so much to ask of people, but I did it, I think, the world's only accurate version to Freddie's harmonies, which was so complex. It took me so long to hear everything. And I taught it at every unique show, and it took me over 2 years, and it was over 100,000 people involved. But I think we did it.
Oh.
And I will never do anything like that again. It was insane.
I just had this very strong vision of Wim Wenders' film Wings of Desire, and about the angels coming down on earth. I'm not religious personally, but there's that classic scene with the angels in their trench coats leaning over the guy in the library, and it's just the most profoundly moving scene and film, and I just had this sense of you being like an angel on earth. I've got to say, that sounds so twee, but it just that scene entered my soul.
Well,
just
it was
then.
Nearly a nun.
No, exactly. Please thank the wonderful Astrid Jorgensen.
Thank you so much.
If you haven't followed Big Ideas on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts yet, now is your chance, and you can share this episode with your friends for their summer road trips. Big Ideas is a really good one for that. Astrid Jorgensen is founder of Pub Choir. Her new memoir is called Average at Best. It's published by Simon & Schuster Australia. Thanks to Kristen Gill at Northern Books in Castlemaine for organising this event at the Fitzroy Town Hall in Melbourne. I'm Natasha Mitchell. I'll be back with you next time with another fabulous episode of Big Ideas. Keep singing. See ya.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.